I am going to talk about storytelling for learning and innovation. I'm going to be talking about the power of storytelling, but I'll also be talking about the limits of storytelling, what storytelling cannot accomplish, and be talking about why great knowledge management programs fail. And I'll be talking about a dangerous tribe of people that are wandering around the world running organizations. It's summed up to some extent in how dangerous they are. Osama bin Laden is professionally envious of BP. Professionally envious. He could never have masterminded something as elaborate as that. These people are quite dangerous. I was born in Sydney, Australia. I grew up there. I studied psychology at Sydney University. I studied law. I worked in a big law firm. And then I went to Oxford University in England, studied some more law. And then I came to Washington, D.C., and I joined the World Bank. And I was a very left-brain, analytic kind of person. Clear, crisp, succinct, bottom line, that was me. And as you may know, big organizations love that kind of person. So I climbed up the managerial ladder in the World Bank. And by 1996, I was actually the director of the Africa region. The Africa region handles a third of the operations in this big international organization. So I was beginning to think this is a pretty important kind of position. But then big changes in the organization. Suddenly I have no job. And asked to look into information, which was like being sent to Siberia. In the World Bank. But I was kind of interested in information, but I saw that that wouldn't really fix what our organization needed. We needed to share our knowledge. And so I had the idea, why don't we share our knowledge with the world? Why don't we share our knowledge with all the millions of people who make decisions about poverty? Then we could actually be a pretty interesting kind of organization. And the funny thing was, no one listened. No one gave a damn about my idea. And nothing happened until I finally figured out how to tell a story that could communicate that idea. Suddenly we were off to the races. The president announced it, became a huge program, and in fact, 4 years later, we'll be benchmarked as a world leader in knowledge management. So storytelling can be enormously powerful. And I left in 2000 and went on to other things. I wrote 5 books on storytelling and leadership storytelling, how you could use the power of this amazing tool to mobilize of big organizations, big stodgy, change-resistant organizations like the World Bank, and turn them into cutting-edge organizations. So it was pretty exciting stuff. But I also noticed around 2008 that these great programs that we were able to launch didn't stick. They didn't sustain. And that many of the great knowledge management efforts came to grief. I looked at what happened in BP. Kent can tell us about that. I looked at what happened in IBM and Ernst & Young. Larry can tell us about that. And I saw in the World Bank that after I left, they appointed somebody who was very docile, kind of yes man who wouldn't rock the boat, wouldn't cause any trouble. They defunded the program. And it still kept going because there's still, even today, 80 communities of practice all across the organization. People passionately believe in it, but without any support from the top. So a certain amount of entropy set in. And I started to ask myself, why do these managements cut and close down these programs, which are the life and soul, the heart of the future of these organizations? What is going on? These are not bad programs. These are programs that have clear objectives, producing wonders, and all the statistics in the world. These smart, intelligent managers would close them down. What is going on? So I started looking into this in early 2008. And the first clue was that it wasn't just knowledge management. When I looked at lean manufacturing, this really got underway globally in the early 80s. And there was a big collaborative study done on what's going on because Toyota and some other firms were outperforming their competitors by a massive amount, tremendous, huge gains in productivity. There was a big collaborative study to document what's going on. In fact, they did document that. The gains were real. It wasn't because of cheap labor. It was because they had a superior management method. In fact, the best factory in the whole world, documented in this study, in this book, The Machine That Changed the World, is a Ford plant in Mexico, the Hermosillo plant in Mexico. It wasn't a Japanese plant. It wasn't a plant run by Japanese. It was run by Ford in Mexico. And you've documented as the best plant in the world. So you think Ford would jump on this. They'd be proud of it. They'd promote it. It would spread throughout Ford. On the contrary, it was basically closed down. Same thing happened. A brave manager replicated the same thing at the Romeo plant in Michigan, exactly the same thing. He was fired. It didn't take. The organization was closing it down. Same thing happened in marketing. Look at a wonderful book, War in the Boardroom by Alan Laura Reese. 25 ways in which management kills great marketing programs. It happens in leadership storytelling, that I could launch a whole leadership storytelling program in an organization, but waiting in the wings were some of these managers who were looking to close it down, and eventually they would close it down. Didn't matter if you had the support of the top of the organization, you were still at risk from these mid-level managers who were going to close it down. So I said, why is this? Why are all these creative ideas, knowledge management, innovation, marketing, storytelling, all of these things being closed down by management? What are the elements of management that cause people to do these, apparently intelligent people to do these unintelligent things? And so I started to document what are the basic tenets of management that these people are doing. What is the mental model that they have wandering around the world causing these kinds of problems? And I found it everywhere. I looked in management textbooks, read Harvard Business Review, and saw what business schools are teaching. And there is a standard mental model of how you manage. And it's about command and control. It's about economies of scale. It's about cost reduction. It's about having clear plans and telling people what to do and controlling and making sure they do it. And the main planks of the of this approach are, number one, that management is a success. This is how you run organizations. An unchallengeable proposition, this is the way organizations are run. And number two, this proposition is not amenable to any evidence which is contrary to that. A wonderful, huge study just published last year by Deloitte, the Deloitte Center for the Edge, and it's called the Shift Index. And they studied 20,000 U.S. organizations from 1965 till 2009. And they came up with some astonishing findings. They found that the rate of return on assets of these firms had declined by 75% since 1965. Looked across all different industries, pretty much common pattern. Some were slightly better, some basic pattern. These industries are going downhill. The life expectancy of firms in the Fortune 500 has declined from 50 years to 15 years. And if things are going to continue, a couple of years, they'll be at 5 years. The life expectancy of a firm in the Fortune 500 by 15 years going to 5 years. The percentage of people who are fully engaged in their work, 1 in 5, 20%. Four out of five people not fully engaged in their work. And if you have a modern organization which is depending on the energy and insight and enthusiasm of your staff, not having motivated staff, not having staff who are fully engaged is a huge problem. Many other variables they looked at, a picture of general disaster. So I was talking with one of the workers in this. He's the co-author of the book The Power of Pull, John Hagel and John Seely Brown. And Lang Davison. I was talking about Lang Davison and said, well, what happened when you presented these findings to big organizations, to managements? And they said, they don't believe it. They simply do not believe it. We've done this massive study, 20,000 of them. They simply do not believe it. They said, how could we be as bad as that if Wall Street is valuing our firm so highly? Collective delusion is what he calls it. They pay no attention to it. So they are working ahead on economies of scale, on cost reduction through downsizing and outsourcing, a standard pattern of management that is leading to these kind of results. So I started to ask myself, what can be done about this? are there organizations that are doing things differently? And I found, in fact, that there were. There are organizations which have a different set of assumptions, because the traditional management set of assumptions are interlocking. They kind of reinforce each other. And once you have that mental model in your mind, having a single management fix, like knowledge management or storytelling or innovation, it doesn't stick. It doesn't hold, because you have these managers, you have consultants, you have MBA graduates who are coming into the firm, and they're looking around for something to cut, where we can cut costs. So something like knowledge management is the perfect quick win, perfect low-hanging fruit where you can cut it.
I'm getting a little nervous in this stuff.
No, write that down.
There's managers out there looking for my throat.
Well, that's my message.
Low-hanging fruit for a consultant.
That's one part of the message, is that the life expectancy of these initiatives is not long, unless your organization is being run in a different way, with a different set of attitudes and values and approaches. And that's what my new book is about. What are this different set of attitudes and values and approaches, and how does it work? And they're summarized on the back of that handout, which you have. And it starts from, first of all, focusing work on delighting clients, or in the public sector, delighting stakeholders. Finding out who you're making a decision about, who are the people you are trying to satisfy, and then exceeding their expectations, providing a continuous flow of additional value to those people, committing the entire organization to that goal, not just the innovation department or not just the research department, but the entire organization focus on that is our goal. And you see it in organizations like Apple or Starbucks, Southwest Airlines, where they have the whole organization focus on, we are trying to delight our clients, not satisfy them, not deliver goods and services, not make money. Our goal is to delight our clients, delight our customers. Secondly, worked in self-organizing teams, like scientists, a bunch of scientists. You can't manage scientists, you can't manage knowledge workers, you can't supervise them. You have to give them the space where they can do their thing, otherwise they're going to be grossly unproductive. And so you see firms that have committed to a goal of delighting their stakeholders or their clients, they naturally gravitate to some kind of self-organizing team. Thirdly, working in short cycles, working in short iterations, so that you can see clearly, are these self-organizing teams actually making progress to the goal of delighting clients? And fourthly, at the end of each cycle, end of each iteration, deliver value to the client, so that you don't have long activities going on for years and then you find at the end of the day it didn't work. You actually work in short cycles and see, are you steadily adding value to your client at the end of each cycle? Radical transparency, 15. Total openness about impediments to an organization. Typical bureaucracies, typical large organizations, things are very non-transparent. You can go on for years, even decades, with huge problems lurking in the background, and they never come to the surface. This is about identifying impediments on every cycle. What are the impediments that are preventing you from delighting your clients, and making that a practice throughout the organization so that problems immediately emerge? This is one of the difficulties with implementing this, is that suddenly a whole huge load of stuff comes out of the woodwork. All of the things that have been hidden in a bureaucracy suddenly become immediately apparent. And so there's an initial shock of horror as people suddenly see how bad things really are. And some organizations at that point back off and say, let's cover everything up, let's go back to bureaucracy and reports. Other organizations take things by the handle and say, let's fix it, let's deal with these problems. Once you get into this mode, then teams typically get into a mode of self-improvement, continuous self-improvement, because the team has the latitude to get on with their job. They have a worthwhile goal, delighting their clients, impediments being removed. You create a context in which the teams themselves continually get better, and you give them tools, metrics, so that they can in fact see whether they're getting better. And then finally, storytelling, interactive communication, a way of interacting with people as adults, not telling people what to do in a sort of adult-child relationship, but let's discuss, let's have a conversation. Let me tell you about my experience. You have a different experience? Well, let me hear about it. You're having a conversation. These are the seven basic principles of organizations that do this. And in fact, this is happening all around the world. It began in most unlikely group of people, geeks. It began with software people who were basically in the mid-80s, 90s, were a disaster. They couldn't get anything done. And so they had to invent a way of managing that could make things happen. So this has now become a huge movement in software development. It's called under names like Agile and Scrum. And they have a terminology that's kind of unintelligible outside software. But these are the people who I think are the most advanced in figuring out how to make work fun, how to make work productive, how to make work continuously innovating and deeply satisfying to the people in it. And so the book is about how that is now spreading beyond software development. It also, lean manufacturing was another area, Toyota, an example of a company that's to a large extent run in that fashion. It's now spreading to all different types of work. Because when you introduce this in software and you suddenly see this bunch of, they seem like no-hopers before, suddenly they are doing wonders and generating all of this cool stuff. You say, well, if that could work in software, why not elsewhere? So it's moving into accounting and legal work and consulting and all parts of the work. It's not limited to software development. So the book is about cataloging the organizations that are doing this and showing how you can do it in your organization. So there's seven basic principles and more than 70 practices that you can use to implement the principles. And what does it mean for knowledge management programs? Well, good news and bad news. One, realize that there are a whole lot of consultants and MBA-trained managers out there who have this mental model of traditional management in their mind, and they are looking around for things to cut, costs to cut, and a program like knowledge management is a sitting target for those kind of people. Cut it, no immediate harm to the organization. Long-term disaster, of course, but a quick win, low-hanging fruit, perfect target for one of these things. So first message is get your ship in order. Make sure your ship is seaworthy. Make sure you have clear goals, you have vibrant communities of practice, you are sharing knowledge, you have metrics which demonstrate this. That's a kind of prerequisite. Without that, you are in real trouble. So even if you have that in place and you have the world's best knowledge management program, you are still in grave danger if your organization is run by people with that mental model of traditional management in their head. You are not safe. So second step is check your organization. Is your organization one that's being run in a traditional management mode, or is it being run in this new mode, what they call radical management? If it is in being run in the new mode, radical management, inviting clients, self-organizing teams, if that is the dynamic of the organization, you can heave a sigh of relief, at least for now, until there's a change in the management. But if it's being run in the old style, you are in significant danger. No matter how well it's run, no matter what support you have at the top of the organization, some accident is likely to happen unless you can, in fact, change the organization and persuade them to be run in this new way. And so you need to have a parachute for yourself and your program. What happens, as in BP or in Hewlett Packard or in IBM?
Maybe I'd like to hear what some other NASA people think, but some years at NASA myself, the impression is we have a lot of things, and you've heard some of that from the science,